Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 35, titled Misplaced Confidence.
Okay. Well, in order to work on not finding the not finding, the first thing you have to do is try to find and fail. So it's not really a problem for anyone until you've really not found. When you look for the real, first of all, and the first step in that is to find in yourself the fact that you assume you are a really real self. Not just a real self. If you can assume you're a real self, you have one, you are one. But what we are assuming is that we, unless we're enlightened, is that we really real selves. You know, like an extra edge of the real. So then, first we have to acknowledge that we feel that, and we almost have to use the inference, because we all want to be goody-goody, and we all want to be like cool and realistic and enlightened and many things, and actually you can quickly glance inside yourself and feel, oh yeah, yeah, I know I'm just an anatomy and this and that, and actually the nihilism has like a good side to it, the materialist scientists, in that they dissect everything, and it's all nothing, they think. They think they find the nothing of it. They found that. They think so, because everything's dissected, you know? So we can hop on their thought experiment and their sort of reality teachings very easy and dissolve everything, right? But when we do that, aligning it together with admitting to ourselves that we don't really agree with that, because when we're upset, that upset is the realest thing in the world, and we'll trample anybody about it. Or when we're threatened our life, we'll kill the other one. And you know, we feel justified in doing so, because ours is more real than their life is, you know. And so that's when we find that there's a really real self here that's more real than other things. When we find that, then we really look for that. We decide, in case, because we sort of respect these enlightenment people, or we wouldn't, I mean, you do, or you wouldn't be here. We sort of think maybe they have something going, you know, that they, like Dalai Lama seems like a cheery camper in spite of the fact he's presiding over a nation that's suffering genocide from a vast, huge thing, and the real world is turning its back on it because they want to make money out of the Chinese. And yet he's cheery on top of that, facing death. And his people who he deeply loves are dying and being killed. So therefore, he must have something going on to be able to still be cheery. He's either a total psycho or he's like has some different consciousness. And yet, by remaining as cheery, still try to do something about the deadly situation. And use the cheer, actually, needing the cheer to have the energy to do it, actually, in fact. Which is actually correct. But, and not really hating even the evildoers, but part of the being cheery. Never giving up on them. So that's the first thing. So first we find that there's something we think is really real, and we don't necessarily agree with all this stuff. We don't even agree with the nihilist scientists either, and we don't agree with the relativist scientists, is what I would call the Buddhist relativist scientists. And then we first do that. Then we look for that. Then, as I predict, and as they have predicted, and their psychological or phenomenological literature predicts, if we really do that with the yogic concentration, effort, and sustained effort, takes time, we will come to a place of not finding anything. And in a way, not finding the not finding ahead of time in an inferential or intellectual way is important in that, actually. Because there are some threshold moments when you go really deep there where fear arises, serious fear. Oh, I'm obliterating my mind. Am I artificially creating an Alzheimer's state where I won't know who I am or who anything, what anything is? Will I become a vegetable who doesn't even know like what my body is? I mean, this is good because this goes really, really deep. The sense of absolute me, and I'm confidence in all my network of concepts is so strong that when we drill through it and realize how arbitrary it is, there's a fear that we'll be completely disoriented forever, right? And we'll become like catatonic or something. There are all these kind of fears, or we'll become nothing. We'll annihilate ourselves. We'll die, assuming death to be sort of a complete oblivion. There are threshold moments like that. And the way of going through them and overcoming that fear of recoiling from them is, I could never become nothing because it's not a thing and it's not a place. So whatever this is, you know, I can't be stuck in it. It's like you jump out of a plane and overcome the fear of the skydive, of being smashed and crushed on the ground or smothered by the speed of the air going by and your lungs collapsing. You overcome that fear by knowing you have a parachute. That's where intellect helps a lot.
But what if it's your intellect that feels like you're going crazy?
What?
What if it is the intellect that's actually...
Well, that's why that's more difficult than overcoming the fear of skydiving. But...
Is that fear?
The intellect is very powerful. That's one of American people who do spiritual paths. One of their big problems is they've all been educated up to kazoo through up to the PhD and the doctors and the lawyers and everything. And yet they're still fucked up, excuse my language. And they're not really that happy. So then they assume that all that learning was useless on an existential level. They assume that. So therefore, they are very vulnerable to the sales pitch of meditation people who say the big thing is don't think anything and then you'll be fine. You don't have to learn anything. Just don't think. All that thinking you did was really a pain in the neck. And your intellect is unreliable and it can't help you. That's false, actually. It can't help you. You desperately need it. Just like you need it when if you want to skydive or if you have to jump out of a plane, you know, you need to know that you have that a parachute works and which lever to pull. And that's conceptual knowledge. Except in the case of Bill Gates. You know the joke?
No.
Well, Bill Gates and the Dalai Lama and a hippie were in an airplane flying to Las Vegas together. Uh-huh. And they got in a terrible storm. And Bill Gates was flying because he's all-knowing and he's the smartest man in the world. He was also the pilot. And the pilot was flying. That's right. And Bill Gates and the hippie and the Dalai Lama. That's right. And so the pilot comes and says, I'm sorry, we have to abandon ship, but there's only 3 parachutes in this plane. And I've got one of them, goodbye, and jumps out. And then Bill Gates says, well, I'm sorry, but I'm the smartest man in the world. No, I forgot. I'm sorry how many people I'm getting wrong. Anyway, he says, I'm the smartest man in the world, so I've got to survive. I'm terribly sorry. So he grabs a parachute and he jumps out. And says, then the Dalai Lama says to the hippie, okay, there's one more parachute here. You take it. Go ahead. I'm the Dalai Lama. I'll be reincarnated. No problem. So the hippie said, no, that's all right, Your Holiness. We can both jump. There are 2 parachutes left. The smartest man in the world just grabbed my backpack and jumped out of the plane. I'm sorry. I apologize. I just thought we should lighten up since you're having a freak out there about your intellect. So, and that's mean to Bill Gates. I apologize, Bill Gates. I know you're wonderful. And you're listening to Melinda, so you're improving. So, saving the world right through the foundation. So the point is, one thing about not finding, at least knowing that intellectually ahead of time, is very, very important to you. That's the royal reason of relativity, which you know, because that helps you when you get in threshold moments that are blocking you from really, you know, letting it all go. And really being reality somehow, you know, without trying to own it and seize it and grasp it and like merge with it, with knowing that there is no state of disappearance that itself is the intrinsic reality. That's not the self. That's very key to know that ahead of time.
Say that one more time.
The experience of disappearing into a vast space will not be the ultimate state. Nirvana is not a state apart from the world. There are states like that seem to be completely apart from everything. The Buddha taught them in terms of what are called the 4 non-material states. And they are, or media in a way. You know, state is okay, but it's not a realm. They're states, or media. And these are infinite space, infinite consciousness, absolute nothingness, a state of absolute nothingness, and a state beyond consciousness and unconsciousness. the four subtlemost states that the yogi can attain, any of which, if we attained with our normal absolutizing habit patterns, concretizing of everything we experience pattern, we would think we'd reach the end of the universe, and we'd reach the ultimate reality of the universe, just like the very, very untrained, unyogic, and philosophically naive scientists, when they don't find anything on the atom, they think they've found nothing. When you put an EEG on a corpse, this one guy in Bellevue who wants a Nobel Prize, big fMRI guy, he put a corpse in an fMRI machine and nothing was happening in the brain of the corpse. So he felt he'd found nothing in that brain. And they felt that the real mind, there is no real mind of the person, because when the brain is not functioning physiologically, there's nothing there. So therefore, that's a proof that you're nothing at death. Assuming that the nothing that you personally are stays with your body. And it fails to be detected by the fMRI. Therefore, the fMRI discovered a nothing that is your nothing, and therefore he's proved that you don't exist after death. It's showing he's insane. He doesn't know what he's saying. Okay? So that's good about the not finding of the not finding. That might help about the not finding of the not. Now, the thing about compassion is, of course, you are compassionate to your own fingertip without a problem. It's non-dual from your sensitivity. When you stick it on a hot pot, you remove it, and then you put cold water or hot water or ointment or whatever it is that you do. You know, about the owl. And you don't say, you don't expect the finger to say, oh, you're so kind, thank you so much. It's just natural. So you go to where your sense of boundary between self and other dissolves under analysis like everything else. And then you're in a field where the feeling of other is right there too. And it's not you anymore. So therefore, you're automatically compassionate for other people. That's why the ultimate great compassion, universal compassion, is said to be the compassion that has no object. That is to say, it's not a subject apart from another object.
Mm-hmm. So when you say compassionate for another person, it's not that for another person.
That's well, no. Ultimately, it isn't. But relatively, if you're someone who has that kind of expanded field of enlightened being, then you can still manifest as a seemingly separate body and put on some bandage or whatever it takes that might help the person or give a teaching. The ultimate thing is, of course, enable the person to understand this quality of their, that even their pain is only illusory pain, even though it's still painful and they can illusorily heal it. But it's not the double pain. You know, like when I have a pain, being unenlightened, it's a really real pain. And it's a pain that I have a pain. And I'm going to all tangle up more and more about the pain, and it gets worse and worse. Okay? So let's go, we can go on that one. And the whole thing about biology and the physics of this emptiness and the physics of seeing yourself, your own neurons, subatomic particle dissolve into the past, the wave particle paradox and everything like this, and yourself viscerally and physically experiencing it, so it becomes a physical scientific discovery. The point of all of that, why I hammer on it so much, is that we have a misplaced confidence in what we're told is reality, not from religions, but from people who are supposedly the quote-unquote natural scientists. And therefore, although we meditate, and we go for diet, and we try to figure out nutrition, since they don't study nutrition, the so-called doctors, they have 2 hours in 9 years of study of nutrition. And we have to figure it out ourselves, and we do all this thing, we get some herbal thing, we do that and do that. But finally, when they say, you have a tumor, it's growing there, or your blood is doing something. We'll now take out your marrow, we'll put some marrow in from some Maori in New Zealand, we have some fresh marrow that matches you, and the weird crap they do, and they make $1 million. That's where our confidence is. And we have no confidence in these other things, so we cannot heal ourselves. And we don't really have confidence. That's why my teacher, I told you the story. One of his interruptions of me, I was meditating away 3 a.m. in the chapel in New Jersey at this temple we built there together. And I was a monk, had my robe, shaved head. As my daughter said years later, I looked like Henry Miller in drag. And I was sitting there like, And he comes in, turns on the light. What are you doing? My old Mongolian guy. I says, what do you mean, what am I doing? I'm meditating. He says, why are you meditating? He says, at this hour instead of resting. I said, what do you mean, why am I meditating? I'm a Buddhist monk. I want to attain enlightenment. He says, oh, you can't attain enlightenment. You're an American. I said, what do you mean? I'm a Buddhist monk, and I believe in former and future life. No, no, no. He says, you have some theories, yes, but you're an American, and when you get enlightened, to get enlightenment, it's your mind that gets enlightened, and you don't believe you have one. And then I argued for weeks with him after that, and argued and argued, but I finally realized what he meant. We don't really have confidence that we have a mind. We really don't. So we don't really think our mind is that powerful. And it's part of the whole culture. That's why we don't vote. That's why we have such a crappy government. And a bunch of absolute people who don't care about us at all. They only care about their donors. We think it's so disgusting we don't vote because we think our vote is meaningless. What we think is meaningless. We are meaningless. We're told that from youth as reality, that you're meaningless. The whole world is meaningless. It's a random accident. Nobody knows how it happened. It has no purpose. It doesn't go anywhere. That's a bunch of superstition, weird creationists. As long as you think that, you will never ask more questions because you think that doesn't matter. The answers. And because you ask questions, you think it matters. So I'm praising you. I'm complimenting.
I'm just a little lost. Why?
You're a little lost.
I am.
Not a little lost. You're very lost.
Maybe
you're
I'm
really, lost. Really lost. I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. What?
I don't understand why if one doesn't believe they have a mind, how that means that you can't be enlightened. Don't you want
to? Enlightenment is the mind. It's mind over matter. Enlightenment is an extraordinary state of awareness.
But isn't a mind a something it's not nothing? I mean, I don't understand that.
Yeah, but the scientist tells you it's nothing. Daniel Dennett has a book, Consciousness Explained. He's a tenured professor in philosophy at Tufts University. And he's a part of a whole network. They all tell you this. And that means that, yes, your brain makes you think you have a mind as long as nobody will lobotomize you. It makes you think so. But the minute the brain stops, boom, it's total unconsciousness. There's nothing that continues that's not the brain.
But you call that the mind?
No, they do.
That continues?
They call it the mind.
Oh, I see.
I call the mind this subtle soul continuum that actually creates the brain, actually. It brings its spiritual gene or mental gene or soul gene from previous lives of vast evolutionary experience that you, Lisa, have had. When you were a zebra, you came to the head of the zebra and said, I have a little question. My stripe, I don't like my stripe on my butt there. And why does my stripe have to go all the way around my butt? And there's no like nice part, it's just solid black. So how did that happen?
But your monk roommate, he said you... because
No, not roommate, my teacher.
No, he said you couldn't reach enlightenment because you didn't...
He was getting me to dig deeper.
Soul, did he mean the soul continuum that you're talking about?
He did. What he meant was he was getting me to dig deeper in my reality sense, which was not necessarily changed that easily by me saying, oh, yes, I think there's former and future life. Mm-hmm. It wasn't changed so easily. Mm-hmm. It had to go deeper to find that reality sense. And that's why, for example, in writing about sort of Buddhist medicine, which is what Menla is about, you know, Ayurveda, acupuncture, doing these different things, you know, one has to first question the misplaced confidence. In that, like, I have a friend who at mere youthful age of 76, who was healthy as a horse. He was tremendously macho and healthy on his second marriage, adored his children, small children, you know, etc. And, you know, knowingly, the wife married him when she was still of childbearing age. He was an elder, you know. But they were happy to do it. They were a happy couple, perfectly happy. And then suddenly he's told by these people, you have this very rare and dangerous leukemia. And he was trying to be hip with his yogic wife and all this, you know, Ayurveda, Matabi Joyce, the whole thing. But the minute they told him that, oh yes, take me and put me in the machine. And we all did divinations, we consulted shamans, we did many things, and he could have had a few more very good years if he'd gone, and he lived in California where they do lymphatic drainage, they do acupuncture. Steve Jobs lived 7 years with pancreatic cancer, and then only went in the last year and a half to those people and quickly died. But they tell you when you have pancreatic cancer, you're finished within
right.
6 months.
3 months, right.
And he lived 7 years with that diagnosis and made more iPhones and made more billions and, like, annoyed more employees, by doing non-conventional things. But then he finally collapsed to the conventional and they killed him. And of course, then they wrote books about him. Oh, he should have gone to the conventional thing right away. He was so stupid. He would have. But the conventional thing gives you no time with pancreatic cancer. That was an irrational thing they wrote because they're part of the machine themselves, the biographer. I won't mention the name. But their sponsors are the people who own the machine. So this guy died like a mummified, weird Egyptian person, like this for months of whatever life they let him have. They matched all these marrows and they poisoned and they did all this crap to him. And he, you know, against everyone else, all his friends, everyone, please don't do that. But that's where his faith was. Mm-hmm. That's where his placebo effect, that's where his belief system was. And it was very sad, I think, personally. He was a good friend. It means that, so that's why I thought that karma biology business is a big deal. I told you that now Thomas Nagel, a professional philosopher, has a good book, Mind and Cosmos, where he reasons in a very calm manner and very modern philosophy acceptable manner, analytic manner. That the attempt to explain reality about through materialistic reductionism as if the world of sheer objectivity still exists lit by people in denial that they have a subjectivity that's part of the measurement that they consider to be what was solving everything is doomed to fail. It's completely non-coherent. And there must be, and they assume they have to stick to it no matter what because the only alternative is a fundamentalist theism, you know, sort of like some simplistic soul theory. And there must be a mind theory that is scientifically, there must be a way of dealing with introspection and subjectivity scientifically that can then be a scientific biology that involves the mind, involves the mind. And he's calling for the karma theory, basically. That's already anticipated by thousands of years. That's what the karma theory is. Your mind is one of the three genetic factors. It's at the gene level. The mind has a gene level. Just like your nostril, that you just your nose it has a pattern, has a gene instruction, so your child's nose will resemble it, and it resembles your parents. So there's a subtle place where the nose potential is hanging out. So therefore, what's in the subtle level of your mind, your basic mental openness or closedness, or rigidity, your paranoidness or your lovingness is encoded. And that will determine then what kind of genes of which kind of species and animal you will gravitate toward in a subtle dreamlike plane, in a matrix-like dreamlike plane when you go through the rabbit hole, the ultimate rabbit hole that everybody goes through, not just Neo in the Matrix taking the red pill instead of the blue pill. We all take the red pill when we die, which we all will do. And then you go out of control. So, but what your fundamental state at the deepest level of encoded openness and receptivity and resilience versus rigid imposition of paranoid sort of, I'm just want to be like this and I'm holding on to that, will determine what you'll gravitate toward. It's very imaginable as a mechanism. You know, the mechanism of it is very imaginable. And that's where science should go. And like I was telling my friend who left early, our dear friend Scott, the scientists should be trained to cope with this. They should have meditative training, yogic training, as part of their physics PhD. Then they would be a different kind of chemist or physicist or computer scientist or neuroscientist. They would be more effective. They would go deeper in understanding the mind and brain when they could look at the mind and brain internally with their own mind, with their more subtle mind. They could look inside themselves. They could like give a break to the monkeys that they're slaughtering madly. No, they could give them a break. They might do in a couple of monkeys to test out a little toxic something, but they would, the level that they do uselessly, slaughtering them by the hordes, is terrible. Really bad example to life, you know, and to their own karma.